So, welcome to Blue Stockings. My name is Guy. I'm a collective member here. We're a volunteer-run, collectively-owned bookstore, radical bookstore in the Lower East Side. We've been around for the last 13 years. Thank you all very much for coming to our presentation. I would like to introduce Victoria. Before introducing Victoria Love, this event is, there's a suggested donation of $5. Of course, like, nobody will be turned away for lack of donations. If you can donate $2, that'll be appreciated. $1,000 would definitely be appreciated as well. All the funds go directly towards sustaining this amazing space. I'd like to introduce Victoria Law, who is an author, activist, mother of burgeoning superheroes that we're all very excited for, and the co-editor of Don't Leave Your Friends Behind. We had a book release party last Saturday, which was absolutely phenomenal. Unfortunately, or incredibly fortunately, we sold out of all the copies, and there will be new copies coming in the next couple of days. So without further ado, Victoria Law.
Thanks for having me. Can everybody hear me, or should I use the microphone? All right. I can figure out how to make it come out. So, welcome everybody. Thanks for coming out. So, I always start my presentations by asking questions. So I'm going to ask two questions of you. Just by a show of hands, how many of you know who Eleanor Rush is or have heard the name? How many of you know who Carol Crooks is or know the name? It doesn't count if you've heard it from me. Okay, so to catch everybody up and to sort of frame this event as one of resistance and organizing in women's prisons in many different forms, I bring up these two names because they did, these two women were the catalyst for significant rebellions in women's prisons. Am I squeaking through the microphone? Okay. Mm-hmm. So, in 1954, in North Carolina, there was an 18-year-old black woman named Eleanor Rush. She was incarcerated at the North Carolina Women's Prison in Raleigh. Good?
Sorry.
Okay. And during the course of her incarceration, at some point she was placed in solitary confinement for 6 days. For those of you who don't know, solitary confinement is you're placed in a cell by yourself. You are not allowed out of it for 23 and a half to 24 hours a day. You have no human contact. Your food gets slid in. It's a form of torture. And she was in there for 6 days. And then to compound this, on the seventh day, the guards decided that they just weren't going to feed her. Don't know why, but they just decided that she wasn't getting any food that day. And after over 16 hours of not being fed, she began yelling through her cell door that she was hungry and that she wanted food. And instead of bringing her anything, the guards came and bound and they gagged her and they dislocated her neck in the process. And then half an hour later, Eleanor Rush was dead. Now, this story might have just been another story of prison injustice and prison murder, except that the next morning, when the women who were not in solitary confinement got out, were allowed out of their cells and went to the prison yard to enjoy the sunshine and walk around and talk with each other, another woman in the solitary confinement unit yelled through her window that Eleanor Rush was dead and that the guards were responsible for her death. And immediately the women surrounded the prison guards that were supposed to be supervising them in the yard, and they started asking questions. They wanted to know, how had Eleanor Rush died? What had the guards done to her, because they knew that they were responsible, and why, given that this was 1954 in North Carolina, was the body of a young black woman sent to the all-white hospital for an autopsy. So they knew that there was clearly going to be a cover-up happening. And when the guards didn't have any answers for them, or didn't have any answers that were concrete, definitive answers, the women rioted. And they rioted for 3.5 hours. Keeping in mind, again, that this is 1954 in North Carolina, the riot was multiracial. Women of all races rioted. No one group of women stood out and was like, no, you know, this won't happen to me because of my skin color or because of my race. All of them knew that this was an injustice that could happen to any of them and that shouldn't be allowed to happen. And in response, the prison sent in local police and guards from the neighboring male prison to quell the riot. However, as a result of the riot, the State Bureau of Investigation ordered a probe into Eleanor Rush's death. They didn't buy the prison's explanation that Eleanor Rush, while bound and gagged, had somehow dislocated her own neck to commit suicide, because that was the official explanation. And then, because there was nothing that explicitly prohibited binding and gagging people in prison, the state prison's director had to explicitly ban the use of gags, and he also had to ban the use of another restraining device called the iron claw, which are metal handcuffs that really squeezed tightly and cut off circulation. The prison was also required to pay $3,000 to Eleanor Rush's mother. Now, keep in mind, that's not going to bring Eleanor Rush back, but at the same time, one of the ways that prison systems and other systems of oppression are held accountable is by actually making them open up their wallets and pay for their abuses and have to recognize that they did wrong. And also keep in mind that in 1954, $3,000 was quite a bit of money. It was more than half the yearly salary of the prison warden. And then the prison warden, who had allowed Eleanor Rush and other women in prison to be bound and gagged and suffer egregious treatments, was replaced by a woman from the Family and Children's Service Agency, indicating a shift from a more punitive model that viewed women in prison as irredeemable to a more social services and social work orientation that started to look at, you know, like what could be done for women to keep women out of prison. And the Eleanor Rush death and the riots and the probes and the replacing of wardens and everything else made headlines in North Carolina for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And yet today, somehow, we don't know about any of this. Now let's fast forward 20 years to 1974 and move back up north to New York. And let's talk about the 1974 August Rebellion. So in August of 1974, at Bedford Hills, which is a couple of hours north of here, the maximum security women's prison, five male guards beat a woman named Carol Crooks, who was a prisoner organizer, and placed her in solitary confinement without any sort of hearing. The month before that, Carol Crooks had actually won a court injunction stating that the prison was not allowed to place women in solitary confinement without any hearings. So even though they were in prison, they had the right to due process. So this was clearly retaliation for her having won that court victory. And again, this might have ended, except that the women around her said, enough is enough. You know, we've seen this happen over and over and over again. We've been mistreated, we've been abused, we've been brutalized. And so they rioted, and they protested, and they took over portions of the prison, and they held seven staff members hostage. And they held the prison until the state called in male state troopers and guards from the neighboring male prison to retake the prison. And during the retaking of the prison, 25 women were injured, and 24 women were transferred to the Mateo 1 complex for the criminally insane, again, without any sort of required hearings. But women's communities and lesbian communities rallied on the outside and started putting pressure on the New York State Department of Corrections, and the women on the inside also organized to bring those women back. And the August Rebellion sparked many in the women's and lesbians communities at the time to begin really looking at what was happening inside women's prisons, as opposed to always focusing their energies on what was going on inside male prisons, and doing support work specifically for women in prisons. So we started seeing a lot of the more radical women's groups, and even some of the like less radical and more, you know, mainstream-oriented women's groups starting to look at women's incarceration as a mirror and sometimes an exaggeration of all of the injustices they were fighting against on the outside. And I'm bringing up these two historical examples because if we're not remembering either of these rebellions that were very visible and made headlines both in mainstream news and in regular news for weeks and weeks, is it any wonder then that we're not seeing what other actions people inside women's prisons are taking either then or now? So I want to move into something a little bit more interactive. You know, some of you have sat through this before. But when I say women in prison, what do you think of? You know, what issues or what concerns or what images come to mind? Feel free to call them out.
Outside communication. Calling.
Calling. Phone calls are hugely expensive. They're in like almost, in the states that have collect calls, the collect call rates are like 600 times the rate of, you know, the collect calls that you would have if you were just calling from like a payphone on the outside on the street. In some state prison systems, they don't even have a collect call system. You are allowed to make one 15-minute call a month, you know, that is monitored, and that's it. So communication is really hard. People on the outside and their families can't often afford these kinds of calls. And so communication with families, friends, loved ones is severely limited. Other?
Children.
Children. 80 to 90% of women in prison are mothers, the majority of them to children under the age of 18. How many of you have heard of the Adoption and Safe Families Act? Okay. How many of you have heard of the Adoption and Safe Families Act? All right. So the Adoption and Safe Families Act was passed in the 1990s, and it stated that if a child is in foster care for 15 of the past 22 months, the state and the foster care agencies have to start procedures to terminate all parental rights. And once terminated, that's irrevocable, which means you could get out next month, next year, you know, next week, and you still don't have any rights to that child. And only three states have exceptions to the Adoption and Safe Families Act's timeline. The third state is New York State, and that's because of some of the amazing organizing work done by some of these women sitting in front of you. So we'll talk more about maybe what that looked like later. But for the most part, then, this means that people or children who have incarcerated parents, particularly incarcerated mothers, are more likely to end up legally severed from their parents. And this timeline affects incarcerated mothers five times more than it affects incarcerated fathers, because if you look at the way our society is gendered, when a father goes to prison, oftentimes there's somebody, usually a female relative, but somebody willing to step up and take care of his children, whether it be, you know, his girlfriend, his wife, his ex-wife, his mother, his sister, a cousin, but somebody will step up and take care of his child or children. When a mother goes to prison, sometimes she's the single head of household. Sometimes, you know, her partner is arrested alongside of her. Sometimes her partner, you know, says, I can't, you know, this is not my role, and, you know, takes off. And oftentimes she doesn't have that same, there's not that same idea of social support and societal support for moms who, quote unquote, mess up that, as there is for men who can't somehow do the same parenting responsibilities. Other things that come to mind when you think of women in prison, when I say women in prison?
Yeah. Sexual abuse.
Sexual abuse is huge. And to dispel notions, it's not always what's portrayed in the media, which is, you know, people in prison sexually abusing each other. Oftentimes it's staff and people in positions of power abusing their power and abusing the people inside. Other things that come to mind? Healthcare issues are huge. I mean, prison health care is atrocious across the board. You know, if you're in a men's facility, if you're in a women's facility. But the prison system isn't set up for women's health care needs, which means that oftentimes there's no OBGYN treatment. There's little to no resources for pregnant people in prison. Only 16 states have any sort of legislation against shackling women, when pregnant women, when they're in labor and delivery, even just labor and delivery. And shackling, for those of you who don't know, means that you have, you're handcuffed here, and then you have a chain that goes to a belly chain, and then another chain that shackles your ankles. So basically, you're not really able to move. And one would think that in 2012, this would just be understood as egregious and awful, and it's still not, because we have 34 states that still say this is okay during labor and delivery. And I believe 49 states that say it's okay at any other time during pregnancy. Other things that come to mind? Yes, no? All right. So, and one other issue that I want you to keep in mind, you know, just because it's not something that's talked about in the male prison literature, is abuse and battering. Women in prison, over 50% of people in women's prison report prior histories of abuse and battering from people close to them. And this is people who are self-reporting. So you imagine that the numbers are much higher, because a lot of times people don't want to report this, especially not to some researcher, you know, that works for the prison system or works with the prison system that's just coming in and out of their lives really briefly. So now I'm going to stop, and I'm going to introduce our amazing, wonderful panelists.
Can I say something first? There's this book that just got reissued. I think we should hold it up and encourage people to buy it. It's by this person named Victoria Law. So, all right, so, and if you don't have one, it's a great book. And, you know, we'll talk about it, I hope, during this book party. It's too much. And there are copies for sale over there. And it's a real, it's a, an incredibly groundbreaking, important starting point for prison, not just women in prison.
Thank you. All right, so with that, I'm going to introduce our other amazing speakers. Tina Reynolds is the co-founder and co-chair of WORTH, Women on the Rise Telling Her Story, which is an organization of formerly and currently incarcerated women who have been empowered by their own experiences while involved in the criminal justice system and beyond. She's received a master's in social work from Hunter College and is currently an adjunct professor at York College. She's published pieces on the abolition of prisons, the impact of incarceration on women and children, formerly incarcerated women and policy change, and, you know, as if she needs to do any more, is an editor of an anthology called Interrupted Life, Experiences of Incarcerated Women in the United States. Mercedes Smith was sentenced to 20 years to life in prison and did the majority of her time at Bedford Hills. While serving her time, Mercedes decided to turn her life around. She completed over a year at Mercy College and proceeded to work at the Parenting Center, where she held the position of inmate coordinator of the teen, preteen, and overnight program. Mercedes led several parenting workshops and obtained an HIV peer education counseling certificate. In addition to these inspiring roles, for 7 years, Mercedes also participated in the Puppies Behind Bars program, where she raised and trained numerous guide dogs. Before being released on June 29, 2010, she was named president of the Inmate Liaison Committee. Through WORTH, she continues to advocate for currently and formerly incarcerated women. And Laura Whitehorn, over here, served over 14 years in federal prison for political actions. She maxed out and was released in 1999 and now lives with her partner, Susie Day, in New York City. Laura continues to agitate for prison justice and the release of political prisoners. She's the editor of Safia Bukhari's The War Before, The True Life Story of Becoming a Black Panther, Keeping the Faith in Prison, and Fighting for Those Left Behind, which is right over there. And you can also look at that and buy a copy afterwards. And she was also nice enough to write the introduction to the second edition of Resistance Behind Bars. So please join me in welcoming Laura Whitehorn. Now, how do I take this off without breaking it? Oh, okay. There we go. All right. So rather than have everybody just talk at you, we thought we would make this more of a conversation. So, and around the question of how your experience in prison has influenced the political work that you do today. So, I'm just going to pass it, and you can pass it to whomever you wish.
Okay, well, So I was part of the movements that Vicki was talking about in the 70s. Around, I was in Boston, but around Carol Crooks and around Bedford. Some of my comrades were directly involved. I was doing work in Boston. But when I went to prison, I think it was sort of like technicolor of everything that I had. I visited people in prison, but I had never visited in a women's prison. Because, you know, it was the time of Attica and all this stuff, and I was... And what it did for me, besides personal damage, which I'll talk about in a minute, was that it convinced me that everything I believed about this government and this system, about capitalism, was true, and more so. Because I saw a system that is dedicated to destroying human beings. There is nothing, even with rehabilitation programs, which we fought for and women fight for and men fight for, that was the ultimate result of prison. And then as mass incarceration began to expand the prison population while I was inside, and women, I'm very bad on statistics, I thought it was 800% that I heard Rukia Lumumba say that the population of women in prison has gone up since 1970 to now. It's exponential, more than men, largely because of the war on drugs. And I saw women whose families were destroyed. I saw the result to the community. And I saw the terrible waste of humanity that prisons are, especially in terms of women, because, and you know, I learned this more from your book, Vicki, even though I had lived it and I had lived it, I knew it, but there was something about reading it in your book that the methods of resistance that women in prison engage in are subversive to capitalism, not just subversive to the prison system, because we weren't big enough to stand off against the male guards. You know, I was in a number of different little uprisings and standoffs with guards. We were little. They were big. It wasn't like with the men. They're scared of the men in prison. They weren't scared of us in that way. And we had to band together. We had to find the strengths in ourselves, but more than that, we had to find the strengths among us in order to be able to get what we wanted, make change, threaten the administration, whatever it was we wanted. And what I realized from reading your book was that that in itself is part of what is subversive about the power of people in prison and the power of women in prison. So that's one thing I dedicated myself to when I got out, was trying to be part of groups that recapitulated that, as opposed to the kind of left I had been in the 60s and 70s that was all about leaders and, you know, just what kind of impact could we make, and nothing about sort of what we used to put down as calling it process, but really is about building an alternative so that in the course of fighting for anything, whether it's a tiny reform, you're actually creating revolution. So that's one thing. The other thing that I became dedicated to was making sure that people pay attention to women in prison when they're talking about prisons. I mean, I wanted to get out and talk about prisons, and we do. I mean, there's much more consciousness now than there was some years ago. But the reason for that is not just that I didn't want women to be left behind, and it isn't even just that I think that women have, because of the experiences that we've had and those experiences in prison, we are able to contribute something to revolutionary, to reform, to any kind of progressive movement. It was also because if you don't understand how women's prisons work, you don't understand prisons. Because prisons are about more than keeping people locked up. They're about reproducing capitalist relationships. So, for example, some women in the violence against women movement talk about how we need better laws to send rapists to prison. And I think that prison increases rape because it increases violence, especially in men's prisons, it increases violence, rage, all the things that go into making rape, which is, you know, a crime of violence, not a sexual crime. That's one thing. But for women, it enforces gender roles, and it enforces those roles in a way that is almost invisible and goes on all day and all night, from, you know, you should act more ladylike, stuff like that, to the threat of sexual abuse, which is constant. The threat, I was never raped in prison, but I was molested daily, because in the federal system, it is legal. Every day, you are pat searched by male guards over and over and over. And that enforces self-hate, it enforces repression, because you can't fight back. You know, it's so. Anyway, so that's another point. And if we don't understand that about prison, then we don't understand how prisons reproduce capitalist relationships, including, you know, patriarchy and violence. And the other thing is that I dedicated myself to making sure that we brought political prisoners into every conversation, because when I was in prison, I did a lot of work on political prisoners before I went to prison, and later on, if someone wants, we could define that and everything. But in prison, what I understood is that there is no division between the kind of repression that puts political people who are active in movements in prison, or gives them huge, huge sentences if they break the law, more than they would have gotten if they'd broken those same laws without a political purpose. And the people who are locked up in through the drug wars and through the normal use of laws, which is completely, you know, unbalanced in this country, because both things are forms of repression. And so I came out dedicated to trying to talk about prisons as repression, not just as unjust, not all those things are true, but they are a form of repression, and they mean that everyone on the street is that much more frightened, that our kids have to go through metal detectors to go to school, and that we don't live in a free society. So,
Thank you for having me here tonight,
Vicky.
One of the things that led to me doing the work that I do now, while I was in prison, I just didn't like the fact that the women that didn't have a voice, they was walked over, they was stomped over. Nobody spoke up for them, nobody said anything for them. So I refused to let those underdogs be walked over. It was bad enough that their treatment of us as women inside a prison, they treated the dogs better than they treated us. So I felt like I didn't want them to just walk over them. I had a voice. They didn't treat me bad. I wouldn't allow it. But those women didn't have a voice. And I became their voice while I was inside. I spoke up for them to have visits with their children. I spoke up for them to be able to go outside when they wanted to go outside, even if they were key blocked. I spoke up if they wanted to go outside during key block time and it was raining. 9 times out of 10, the officers didn't want to go outside because it was raining. But you can't stop a woman that wants to go outside. If she's locked in for 23 hours a day, her 1 hour that day, she wants to go outside, let her go outside. I remember one time we didn't have heat at all. And the side of our walls, like the wall, was just a plain wall and it had a sheet of ice on it. And we was like, it's freezing in here, what are we going to do? So we all got together and we decided that we just wasn't going to lock in. And when count time came, we all just sat outside our doors. And the officer was like, y'all not locking in? We was like, no. It was 30 women on one corridor and 30 women on another corridor. And all of us stood outside our door. As long as we wasn't violent or rude or yelling or screaming, it was nothing they really could do. Not unless they just wanted to sit and write 60 women a ticket. They called the superintendent. She came up on the unit. And that one night, we didn't have to lock in. They told us to bring our mattresses and everything out into the recreation room and sleep out there. Of course, out there was warm because all the officers had the heaters surrounding them to keep them warm. It didn't get us heat that night. So a week later, we decided that, okay, staying out is not working. So all 60 women signed up for nurses screening. It's mandated that you go to nurses screening. So if 60 women went to nurses screening, the rule of the facility was, if you sign up for nurses screening, you have to go, else they'll write you a disciplinary ticket. So we had to go to nurses screening. So 60 women could not get to their jobs. And the nurses, they was only used to seeing like 15 or 20 women at 5 o'clock in the morning. They didn't get to us. And so when they got the paper and seen that the whole unit signed, they seen everybody else in the facility. We didn't get down there until 1 o'clock. Another thing that I didn't like was reentry. I felt like there was a reason why women was coming back to prison. I needed to find out what was that reason. When you walk out of the prison doors, they tell you, oh, you're going to be fine, get a job, get an apartment, and you're just going to be great. You're going to go right back into society, and everything is going to be good. That's not true. I know now why they come back to prison. It's not that easy. Society doesn't welcome us back that great. They don't give us housing. They don't give us jobs. So there's nobody helping them. So when nobody's not helping them, they go back to doing all they know how to do. So when I came home, I knew that from all the stories I heard inside, and then I came home and experienced it, I knew that this was something that I needed to do for all my sisters that was left behind. I needed to come out and try and find an easy path for when they come home, when they transition back into society, so things can be easier for them so they don't ever have to go back to prison.
As far as I know. I was telling Mercedes she left a lot of stuff out. You gotta get used to talking about the great work that she's done. So when I was in Bedford Hills this last time around, I was pregnant, and I began to, you know, instead of the times that I'd been arrested before and done state time and accepted how I was being treated, I went into prison prior to that with the mindset, well, I committed a crime. Whatever happens is supposed to happen. If I'm pat searched by men, then that's supposed to happen. If I'm, you know, told that I'm such and such or called names, then that's supposed to happen. You know, if I don't eat, then that's supposed to happen. If the food isn't great, then that's supposed to happen, you know, because I had committed a crime. Mind you, all of the sentences I received were drug-related. You know, I know today that, you know, abusing drugs is a medical issue, you know, and that I had no control over it. I had no control. Once I was in the grips of my disease, that was it. Whatever I had to do to get the next one, I was doing. You know, and it didn't matter who it was, who came down the street, whatever happened, you know, it was about getting the next one. But this last time that I was in prison, I was there for a violation and I was pregnant. And I'd been pregnant before while I was in jail and in prison, but I'd been released. But this time I knew that with my violation that I was going to have to complete the rest of the time that I had, which was 18 months on the back of my sentence. And I was already 4.5 months, maybe almost close to 4.5 months pregnant. And I wanted to make a way for my child to be safe. I had already had a child in foster care, and he was taken by the state, and I didn't know whether I was going to be able to get him back. And at that point, when I was inside, I started talking to the sisters that I'd met in Rikers Island prior to my going upstate to Bedford Hills, and asking them questions about what I could do. I had never used the lines of communication inside the prison before. I had never used my sisters. And I found out that they had a lot of information. And not only that, that they were willing to give me that information and to guide me so that whatever happened to them, if they weren't able to keep their child or if they were denied an opportunity to be on the nursery, they didn't want me to go through that. Even though it had happened to them, they didn't want me to go through that. And I found that phenomenal, you know. And so I started using the information and following their suggestions, and I started fighting for my child. And, you know, I found an alternative to incarceration while I was in Rikers. There were only 3 alternatives for women with children at the time, and this was in the early 90s. And one of them had stepped up and said that they would accept me and my unborn child, plus the child that was in foster care. And I was like, great, I did it. I advocated for myself. I'm winning. I sat in front of the DA. First time we sat in front of each other, she didn't have my record. She says, I have to get your record. You know, make sure that you can get accepted into this program. I'm not going to tell you yes right now because I don't have your record in front of me. But when we come back and we meet next week, I'll make my decision. So when we came back, a week later, I sat in front of her. She had my record. I'd been arrested 61 times, right? Had done maybe 2.5, 3 years already upstate. My record was this thick. She flipped through it, and she looked at me, and it was like looking in the mirror. And she says, well, you're going to be what you've been all this time. You're not going to change. She says, so the alternative is off the table. You're going to always do what you've always done. You're going to always be what you've always been. And I was pissed off. 24 hours after that, I was transferred to Bedford. I was shackled and I was handcuffed. I think by then I was maybe 4.5, 5 months pregnant. For the ride, which was an hour from Rikers to Bedford Hills. And I was angry. And again, here I'm in a prison, but now I'm being placed in an environment where there are other pregnant women, and I begin to ask questions again about how did they get on the nursery? Did they get on the nursery? What stopped them from getting on the nursery? Was it their crimes that they committed? Was it the fact that they had children before and they may have abandoned them or neglected them or whatever? But how did they get on the nursery? Because I had to see whether I could, you know, have that opportunity. And again, the lines of communication opened up. People told me who to go to, who to talk to. The superintendent wasn't in the prison at the time, but Sister Elaine Lord was running the Women's Center along with a host of women who were currently incarcerated, and they had all the information. You know, it was a network of women inside the prison that was connected with the volunteers that were coming in, and they had all the information. And in fact, they supported Sister Elaine talking to the superintendent about my getting on the nursery. So this was some time, and I went to the hospital, and I had my son, and I was shackled while I was giving birth to him. Actually, they took the shackle off of the one leg, and they had me handcuffed, right? But I was shackled through the whole time, through labor and in transport and everything. And so to make a long story tolerable, I had my son. I had to leave him there. I had to go back to the prison. He had been accepted to Hale House, but I wasn't willing to have that happen. At least that was something that I didn't have an alternative before, where he would have gone into the state and been a ward of the state. I had at least been able to advocate for him to be accepted in Hale House, and then after I would have done my violation, I would have been able to get him back. So, but that wasn't enough. He was left in the hospital for 11 days because he had some medical complications. So I went back to the prison and I started fighting, since he was there and I knew he was going to be there this one last time. And again, the women, you know, rallied with me and gave me suggestions, and I talked to Sister Elaine. By then the superintendent had come back, who now is a big advocate for women who are currently home, you know, and are coming home. And I was accepted into the nursery in Bedford Hills. And that was against all policies and procedure because I didn't commit a violent crime. And those that were in the nursery in Bedford were able to have their children with them, and their crimes were not violations. So here I saw that there was no separation. There was an exception made, but it was looking at me like all the other women as opposed to the crime that I committed and or the situation that I was in. And that gave me some hope. So I went to pick up my son. I was again shackled and handcuffed, and my son was carried out by a correctional officer in front of me while I walked behind them with handcuffs and shackles on. And I'm sitting in the van, and I'm going back, and I'm like, if this van turns over, how am I going to help my baby? You know, what's going to happen? You know, and I ended up, you know, having him, but I realized that what I had gotten, a lot of other sisters probably didn't get. They didn't, you know, was it because I'd been to prison so many times? I'd touched on the ground of the state prisons many, many times, even if I didn't stay there long, you know, and I knew how things ran. And I said, well, was it that, you know, or was it just that I was sick and tired of being treated that way? And I realized it was a lot of both, you know. And when I came home with my son, we walked out of prison at 9 months. My son was taken care of by women in the prison when I had to do programs. And they loved him immensely, immensely, more than I could ever ask for. And, you know, children don't know where they're born. They don't know what's around them. I mean, my son, when he talks about it now, he's 18 years old, and he says, yeah, I was born in prison. He says, that's what my mother tells me. You know, and he just remembers all the love, you know, that he's gotten. And it was after I came out of prison where I began to resist and know that I'd left women behind, and I started doing work in the community around shackling, around the Adoption Safe Families Act, around the Department of Health Oversight Bill, and I started gaining a voice, because while I was in prison, that's where that happened for me. And while I was in prison, that's where I saw that women had such power to change certain things, you know, that I never thought would happen in such a punitive environment, a restrictive, oppressive, dehumanizing environment. I never thought, you know, And then it had me even angrier because I said, all those times I was packed first by a man, I could have said no. You know, I didn't have to take that. You know, but it was just like, and no, it wasn't because of the crime I committed, and no, I shouldn't have been treated like that regardless. And so coming out and doing the work that Mercedes and I and Laura do is something that is a continuation of the work that we did or the experiences that we had inside prison. And for women, it's, for me, from my perspective, you know, I've looked at the work that we've done and established an analysis around, you know, the impact. And like what Laura said, it's about, you know, patriarchy. It's about colonization. It's about keeping women thinking that the first thing you need when you come home is a house or an apartment and a job, and no, you don't need that. You know, wherever you are, that's what you have. You know, but the thing is to really break down the way in which the system has broken you down. You have to break it down in order to be successful when you come out. You know, because it's set up so that you fail. Everything is set up so that you fail. And so if you don't break it down, then you're either just trying to fit your way into something that has not invited you into anyway. And it never works. And it never works. So when we do this work at Worth, we think we're combating that. We know we're looking at economic viability of our sisters when we come home. We're supporting them and giving them the safe space and the opportunity to, you know, see themselves wherever they are when they first come home, because you're nervous about it, that you have a chance and an opportunity to sit down somewhere and communicate and talk with someone who's not been to prison in a very long time, or who's just come home and been successful and is probably going back into the prison to assist women who are coming home. So to break down those ideas of what it is that you need to do based on what society says is right for you to do, and to find a different way of doing and resisting so that you can be successful. You know, one of the things that really bothered me was the fact of how my children, you know, my son, when he had, and children that I took up to prison to see their moms, was how they were criminalized, how they were strip searched, and how they were, their diapers were looked at, and how, you know, they had to be touched. You tell a child that no, nobody strange should ever touch you, right? But you have to come up to a prison and see your mom, and these strangers are touching you before you go ahead and see your mom. And then when you go in the place to see your mom, you can't hug your mom. You can't hug her too long, or you can't play with her too long, or somebody's telling you how to play with your mom. You know, so one of the things that I felt that really impacted me was how our children are treated in these environments, you know, and how our children are criminalized, you know, because of the crimes that we've committed. So, I mean, I have a lot to talk about, but I'm going to be quiet right now.
So this leads to my next question, which is, like, so can you talk more about the work that you're doing now that comes from your in-prison experiences, and also share how other people can get involved as well? And then I'll move on to the more challenging ones.
Well, I'm glad I get this first, because then I get to say, you heard Mercedes and Tina talk about the work of Worth. And if anyone wants to contribute to Worth, they can always use... right, donations, and of all different sizes, not just small, not just what you can put into. But okay, you're going to get that. So, so let's see. So, working with Worth, which I tried to do, and which I'm going to be doing more, is one of the great advantages of being a woman. The other things that I've done, as I said, you know, the U.S. government holds probably 100 political prisoners and more every day, because there are now grand juries all over the country. People know, 3 people just went to prison in, I guess, Seattle for not testifying to grand juries that are investigating the anarchist movement. I think some of it was begun around the Republican National Convention demonstration in Minneapolis, and they didn't get what they wanted, so now they're branching out, and some of it's about Wall Street. They're scared. And any time we think that we're being conspiratorial about what the government is doing, don't worry, it's all true. So I am interested in talking about political prisoners and trying to free political prisoners, because there are, for example, in New York State, 6 political prisoners, all of whom were either in the Black Panther Party or supporters of the Black Panther Party, who've been locked up for 30 and 40 years and have parole-eligible sentences but are turned down by the parole board. Not that unusual for people with convicted of violent crimes in New York State, but they get a little extra turn of the screw. And I do feel like we need to do that, because, to quote the name of Vicky's other book, although it's not about this, Don't Leave Your Friends Behind. If we don't build a movement that takes care of our own when we get arrested, then what kind of movement is it? But as I said, I'm also really concerned about the mass incarceration in general. I did edit a book by Safia Bukhari, who was herself a political prisoner and was a Black Panther, and it is over there, and she was a wonderful person, and she did a lot of work around political prisoners, so please look at that. And right now, I guess I'm working on, with a lot of other people, including Worth and other people who do prison justice work, we're working on a campaign to increase the likelihood, let's put it that way, because I don't think we're going to get them all out, of release for aging prisoners, including prisoners convicted of violent crimes, because a lot of times you find in the prison justice movement that people talk about, which is fine, talk about the drug laws and the people who were convicted of victimless crimes and all that, that's very important, but we also have to talk about the people who are in, because when they were, like Jaleel Muntakim, when he was 19 years old, was part of the Black Panther Party, there was a war between the cops and the state. By the way, if people have been following the Times, the New York Times has been won over to the anti-stop and frisk position, so they've had, every day they have some kind of article, and today they had one about the city council hearings yesterday around stop and frisk, and at the end, it was another story that was about the cops killing innocent people on the street, you know, and it compared the numbers for now, and we feel like, because we know that there have been some, Marley Graham, and, you know, there have been so many this year, we feel like there's been a lot, but back in the 70s, and that's the time when the Panthers were fighting with the police, it's, what did it have? It had a number, it was like 370 shootings by the police of unarmed civilians. And I remember that in 1 year alone, there were 63 deaths of Black and Puerto Rican young people on the street who were unarmed. So people who were arrested during that time did something when they were 19, and now they're told you can't get out because you're dangerous. Well, Black Panther Party doesn't exist anymore. That particular war between the cops and the Black liberation struggle is not active right now. Jaleel is in his 60s, great-grandfather, so, and has done everything to take everything you're supposed to do for parole and hasn't gotten out. So he's one example. There are many others who are not political prisoners who have violent convictions for violent crimes and have the lowest rate of recidivism, of going back to prison when they are released, of any category of prisoner. And so we're trying to hit the whole mass incarceration ideology by saying, what is the point of permanent punishment? What kind of society do we want to build now? Healing? Those stories about, you know, that is one of the most moving things about being in prison. I think it's true for men too, but not as much. For women, is that example of solidarity that you get, the coming together of a community of women wherever we are, if we're in prison, to transmit that to society. Do we want to have that kind of society with healing and solidarity, or do we want to have, you know, you stepped on my foot, you're going down, you know, you're going to, whatever, you know, people are going to prison, let's increase hate crime legislation, let's increase, you know, everyone's, all the laws that send people to prison. That's not the society I think we want. So this initiative will also hit on that, but I think, you know, gotta keep fighting for our sisters and brothers. So that's it. I think that's the
one. So what do I do? I go back into the prison. I go back into Bayview and I co-facilitate with Tina for Rise Up program. Well, Rise Up, we're going to let Tina talk about it. Rise Up is a 12-week, and it's an empowerment program. It's nothing that we teach them. It's what they have inside, and what we do is we bring it out of them. We show them how they have been oppressed and how to be liberated. We help them to become liberated. We talk about reentry. We talk about their fears of reentry. We talk about the timeline of the women in prison. We talk about what their health and wellness. We talk about so many different things in the 12 weeks that when they're finished these 12 weeks, they are empowered women. And this is, we teach this, we don't teach this. This program is done through popular education. And it's not that we're the experts, it's you're the expert too, and we learn from each other. It's not that we're going in there and we're telling them we have all the answers. One of the reasons that I wanted to go back into the prison is when I left prison, all the women told me that I gave them hope. Because prior to me making my parole board, women doing 20 years, and 15 years was not making their first parole board. I made my first parole board. So as I was leaving the facility, all the women told me, thank you. I gave them hope. They felt like the sun was shining again and that they was all going to be released. I knew that I needed to go back in and show them that it's good. But I wanted to be honest with them. I wanted to tell them, it's hard, but you could do it. And when you come home, come to work. We're going to help you get your start. We're going to help you get acclimated back to the workforce. Most women coming out of prison, they're not computer savvy. Because we don't have computers in there. We don't know anything about internet. I was fortunate because I worked in a parenting center. All my work that I did on a computer. But most women in prison don't have that opportunity. They don't have the opportunity. A phone ring, they look at that phone. They're not answering it. They look the other way like, yeah, I hear it. Do you hear it? You better act like you don't hear it. Nobody answers the phone, so we teach them to be comfortable. The phone ring, answer it. It's all right. I do outreach. I go out into the community. We're located in East Harlem. I go out into the community, not only in East Harlem, Brooklyn, the Bronx. I go anywhere need be, wherever I know that there's an organization, because I feel like these are my babies coming home. And I feel like we don't do direct services. And the direct services that they need, I want to make sure they get what they need. I don't want to just say, here, go here, it's going to be all right. I need to be able to say to them, I know what they do, and I know you're going to be all right there. When you finish with it, you'll be good. So I really work hard to find these organizations for the women to go to. I supervise the interns when they come in. I talk to them a lot because I think that, you know, women coming home are afraid. And when they walk into an office, and I may be the one person they really know, and I want them to feel comfortable. I mean, I know what it was like when I first came home. I was afraid when I walked into areas. I was afraid everybody was going to look at me and be like, she was in prison. Look at her. Look how she looked. I don't want them to feel that. I want them to come into the office, sit down, be comfortable. I want them to be able to share what everybody else talk about at work. Well, how was your night? What did you do? How's your love life? So, you know, I talk to the women when they come in. What's going on? Are you having problems? I support them. This is what they need. They need support when they come home. Just recently, a woman that's been coming into the office volunteering, her mother died. So, you know, I felt like I'm her sister. I needed to go to that funeral and be there. So when she turned around and looked back, she seen a face that she knew. A face that she felt comfortable with. She told me everything that she was feeling about her mother's death. And I told her, don't worry. I'll be there with you. You're not going to be there alone. I mean, she had a whole host of families there. But it didn't matter. What mattered was that I was there with her. When she turned around and looked, she was like, yeah, I see Mercedes. And she came back and she talked to me and she thanked me for being there. And I may not reach everybody, but I know that if I help one person, my job was done. And that person, I helped one person. Before everybody else comes out of prison, they'll have help. I also go to rallies about releasing people that's on parole. I feel like once you do your sentence, they sentence you to 20 years, once you do your 20 years, there's no need to resentence you by hitting you with 2 years. What more can you do in 2 years that you didn't get done in 20? I have a lot of, I don't have no sisters. My sisters are still incarcerated. And I'm going to fight to help get all my sisters out.
Mercedes does more than that. She's phenomenal. Mercedes has only been home for 2 years. And so just to let you know, she's only been home for 2 years. And she's done a lot, you know. And the work that we do is not for everyone. We definitely let every sister know that when they come in the door, we would like them to do advocacy and policy work. It's hard to do advocacy and policy work. You have to have a voice. You have to be fully self-expressed. You have to establish a political analysis, see how it is that the systems have impacted you, what it is that you gave up. You know, and some of that is deep. Some of that is deep and internal, and it goes back to childhood, you know, and legacy, the way in which your family has raised you. So what we try to do, I mean, WORTH is an organization that works on policy and advocacy, and we take a national and also a statewide and regional perspective. From our national perspective, and Vicki is working on this with us, we've started a campaign to end shackling of pregnant women throughout the whole 50 states. Like she talked about, there are currently 36 states left that continue, 34 that continue to shackle women. Yeah, that's right, LA. And so when we think about the legislation, the recent legislation that was passed in California is the most comprehensive, because it's looking at women through all trimesters and they're not shackling or handcuffing them for any transportation needs. And that's huge. Whenever we pass legislation, we're always taking and looking at the low-hanging fruit because, you know, it's easier to grab. It's easier to get at. And we want to involve formerly and currently incarcerated women in the process. And so you may ask, how do you involve currently incarcerated women in the direct actions and the work that you do? Well, what we do is we have a project where we reach back to the sisters inside and we ask them to answer questions or to fill out a questionnaire or to talk about something that they think that they want to work on or we should work on. And from that information that we gather from them, we either develop a policy or either figure out how we can work this into the work that we're doing. We also, from their information that they give us, we reach out to their families and ask them if they want to participate in any of the work that we're doing. So it's not just the women themselves. We're looking at the whole family, the whole community becoming involved in the work that we're doing to move our issues forward. We want to end the dehumanizing practices in prison. We want to look at women and bring about visibility to the invisible. So the national work that we're doing, we're working with 5 states. And like I said, that's to gather stories for women and their experiences as they've experienced pregnancy from arrest to release. And we want to put those stories into an anthology. We want to assist states that currently have the laws in place where they shackle and handcuff women during labor and delivery. If nothing else, during labor and delivery, look at changing those laws and having formerly incarcerated women involved in that process. Because you can't do this work without bringing people that have been directly impacted into it, because it's not really doing the work. That means that you're just talking about it and saying, well, for these people, we need to have to get this straight for them. You know, so it's not about that. It's about making sure that the people that have been most impacted are empowered, educated, and become knowledgeable so that they can take their voice beyond that particular issue. And then the work that we do nationally with the formerly incarcerated and convicted people's movement, which is the national movement of formerly incarcerated people. And Mercedes and I have been traveling with them, and we've been doing some work in around the planks that we came up with within our organization. And that's made up of over 200 organizations that are either run by or involving formerly incarcerated people. I don't know whether I have anything else to say. I know I have something else to say, but
I have to leave right now, but Tina says that I'm not telling everything, but if you want to know some more of what I did do a documentary, Removing the Stigma of Incarceration, and you could look at it at www.thinkoutsidethecell.com. And just the name of it is Removing the Stigma of Incarceration.
And we're at, the rest of us are not leaving, just Mercedes has to leave, so we're just going to give her a minute. Mm-hmm. So, now that it's just the two of you, I can put you on the hot seat now with the hard question.
You suggested it.
Mm-hmm. So, looking at this idea of not relying on punishment, prisons, guards, police, you know, like state systems of oppression to deal with our problems around conflict and harm. When you were inside, what are some ways that you would deal with conflict without necessarily having to like turn to a guard and be like, hey, this person is harassing me or threatening me or annoying me or something? Like, what were some ways that you or other women?
Well, when I was in, and I know it started to change, that well, there were always snitches, but mostly it was a rule. I mean, you just didn't go to the guards. It did not matter what was happening. You handle your own shit. but there were women who were too weak to do that or too scared or something. I know I'm little, but I grew up being bullied, obviously. I was always little. So I was good at standing up to bullies because I didn't, you know, I just had lost that fear because I knew that it got worse if you didn't stand up. So, and I had also learned from during the 60s from going out in the streets and fighting with the cops that I had the ability to walk right up to them, you know, and they would think, who's this little squirt? You know, and then I would kick them in the knees and they would let someone go. So, you know, it's just using what you have to get what you need. But, okay, so then if there was someone came into the prison and she was being bullied, then three of us would get together. And this happened. This woman, you know, they were in the intake cells, and this woman, the woman who had come in, who was scared, Diane, was on the, I guess she was on the bottom bunk, because there was no one on the top bunk. She comes back from the dining room one day, and she finds her stuff is on the top bunk, and this woman has taken the bottom bunk, and she says, I'm here, and now this is my bunk, and you know, you can. And so Diane, after a couple of days of being scared, came to me, and I got two other friends together, and right after camp, when, you know, people are running around, so it's a lot of chaos, we laid in the cut at the end of camp, and we ran into the cell, and we closed the door, and we said to the woman, look, you have a choice. You can either stop what you're doing and respect her, or there will be a lot more than three of us, and we're going to make your life difficult, because everyone knows that, you know, the prison was completely overcrowded. So in order to get what you needed, like get your clothes in the laundry in the morning or whatever, there was, you know, little washers that would break all the time and it was a big competition, we would make her life difficult. And she backed down. Now, sometimes there were situations where people didn't and where, you know, people would, it didn't work all the time. But it was really important that we did that, and then we talked about it. We told other people, see, there's another way to do this. That was one of the most successful ones. There were other times that were less successful where, especially, I was in prison during the, when the Marielitas were brought from Cuba, you know, when there was a big exodus from Cuba. of a lot of people who were mentally ill were in that, and they were put in the federal system. So I was, and if we ever, especially when I was in the hole, which I was a lot, for, you know, talking back and stuff, until I figured out how to do it without literally, you know, yelling at the cop or something. So by the end of my time, I was less in the hole. But I would always be in the hole with Marialitas, and people would be screaming all night and stuff like that. And the desire to say, you know, put her in the mental health or something like that was really huge, because you really were, you know, it was hard, and people couldn't listen because they were mentally ill. But there was this one situation where a woman was four-pointed by the guards in this control unit I was in Mariana, Florida. Four-pointing is when you are tied to a bed by hands and feet, and you are just completely, you can't do anything. I mean, they feed you. You know, they put food in your mouth. And it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And this woman had been screaming, and there was a woman who had told the guards she was screaming and she was tearing stuff up, and so they had four-pointed her. So we convinced the woman who had turned her in to go to the cops and say, I was lying, you know, they still wouldn't let her out. So it was sort of like what Mercedes was talking about when they sat down outside the cells. We just barraged the unit manager, the counselors, everyone with complaints. We got our lawyers, the people that on the outside that supported us, to call the prison, and finally they got her a psychologist and they took her out of four-pointing. But that was a hard one. That took us quite a while. And then there were other situations where we couldn't, and I think that's part of, you know, I believe that the prison system as it is should be abolished. I believe we should have community control. I think we should have community control in New York instead of the cops. You know, I really believe that. I think it's a very, very hard process. And when people talk about abolition of prisons, they say, well, what about serial killers? What about, you know, really antisocial people? And I think that then we have to talk about what kind of people's prisons could there be that would be, you know, give health care and try to reform people and all stuff like that. I can't really, you know, I don't have a whole plan for it, but I do know that in prison I learned out of necessity more than I had ever known about how to use community control. And you had to listen to everyone's voice, and we had to get tough sometimes with people who were trying to destroy things. There was a woman right before I got out. I had just gotten my date, and I think I was saying before, before we started, the woman who was my lawyer, Susan Tipograph, whom some of you may know, she defends a lot of people in New York City. She and I had so fast-talked on my computation of time that we had managed to whittle a year and a half off without the prison system ever knowing it. My girlfriend gets really nervous when I talk about that. She says, can't they come back and get you? But it was like, I've been out for 12 years. It's too late. It's like, they're not going to want to. So I had just gotten my date. I had gone to the office where you get that. I had just gotten my date. I had an actual date of release. And I knew I was cheating the man of time. And I was so happy. And I went into the laundry room where I had left my laundry drying. And this woman who had been, she'd been in the military, and she was absolutely the most hateful person. She just did so much shit in there. And she cornered me in the laundry room, and she said, she didn't realize that she thought I was a political prisoner. I had these huge sentences like the other political prisoner women I was in with. She said, you're never getting out, and, you know, and you're this and you're that and blah, 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 and I'm going to beat you up. I said, go ahead. Go ahead. Really want to? Go ahead. Go ahead. And all my friends heard it, and they came running, you know, thinking that they had to defend me or something. And I said, no, no, no. Go away. Go away. Watch. And she was completely intimidated by the fact that I said, you want to kick my ass? It won't be the first time in my life I got an ass beating. I don't pray, but I would have been praying that she didn't take me up on it. But she was scared. And that was the first time I ever saw the power of nonviolence. I'd never seen it. I was part of the movement that was like, you know, nah, we tried that. So it was a real example, but it gave me also a sense of, you know, how people can really deal with antisocial individuals and situations. And she became more and more isolated after that. She had been very popular because she would buy everyone commissary, and she was very smooth and all this stuff, and I knew she was a snitch because I witnessed something. Other people didn't quite believe me. Anyway, so that was another example. These are not great examples. Actually, in the introduction to Vicki's book, I write a story about an example that's more interesting from Baltimore City Jail. So if you buy the book, you'll get it.
I experienced women coming in very hurt, coming in very hurt and very oppressed and depressed and mental health issues, so there was no telling what might have happened at any minute, I saw myself as the person. One, I didn't have anything, so you couldn't take anything from me. I wasn't afraid, so I wasn't going to back down. And I wouldn't start stuff. When I was in prison, I learned some things that only prison can teach you. And prison teaches you more of how to, if you are on that side, of how not to be than how to be. Of course, I was confronted by people and challenged, and I just wouldn't back down from who I was. I wasn't going to shoe for anybody. I wasn't going to the hole for anybody. But, I basically stood my ground. There were many instances where I witnessed women that didn't have that voice or that way of being about themselves. And, you had to make some choices. Either you were going to stand with them. And like Laura said, it wasn't something that I would do by myself, but I would maybe tell a friend or another friend that this was happening and either corner the person in the shower or something like that and have a conversation, because my whole thing was that we were all women, if we were going to allow the guards to say whatever it is that they wanted to say and do whatever it is that they wanted to do, then how are we making it any better? With our relationships with each other, and for me that's heartbreaking when women come in and they just don't have that mindset of that these are other women, and their experience may not be my experience, but we're in the same situation. We're in the same situation. We're going to be treated differently regardless whether I snitch or whether I don't. That opposition is going to come at me. And so I think I took that the hardest. It's like, nobody's better than anybody. And I'm definitely not better than anyone, So it was just disheartening to me. I think that's probably why I started work, because we break down all of that way of being, or that false way of being, where we're in competition with each other. Because there's no need for it. There's no need at all for it as women to be in competition with each other. I tell all the members that come in, I want you to have more than I have, and you can have everything that I have and more. And I tell them, I said, you know why? I said, because that means that I can ask you for something.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing is that, I think that's really important, the sense, the stupidest thing you'd ever see in the federal system. You had a lot of sort of high-level embezzlement crimes and people who didn't pay taxes and stuff, and you had the big-time drug dealers. So you had people who were pretty stuck up, a lot of them, and they weren't used to doing their own. So there was this one woman who came in, I think she was an embezzler or something, she got, I don't know, a year and a half. And you have to work in prison. You have to work in the kitchen. It's disgusting, nasty work. And she was like, oh, I'm not going to do this. I'll pay someone to do it for me. People would say, I can't remember, what was the phrase? You ain't got shit. You're here now. You're the same as me. And it was true. It was the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen of this, hoity-toity trying to act like that. But another thing for me that I learned, because I did my first 5 years in Baltimore City Jail and D.C. Jail, which are very poor city jails, and they're third world jails. They're not, the conditions are not what you see in the rest of D.C. If you go down there and you're in DuPont Circle or Adams Morgan or something, it's southeast, and it's a completely oppressed community. And I very quickly, I actually learned it from Mutulu Shakur when I was in MCC New York for about a year. And he said to me, you know, you're still in society when you're in prison. And I thought about that. And as a white woman, white middle class woman, even when I was in prison and the guards had supposedly all the power over me, black guards in Baltimore, who that was the only job they could get, I still had some privilege over them. And that was really important to remember. It didn't mean that I didn't, you know, resist when I was told to do ridiculous things and stuff, but it just meant the kind of relationships you have. And that was always true. So it's just the other thing to add to what Tina's saying is all of that, it just exposes what really exists. Mm-hmm. Because you can miss the layers of racism in society from day to day out here, but you can't miss it inside. And even when you're the one who has white skin privilege, you just can't miss it. Everything is very graphic. And yeah, so... And I would just say, at the end, that's why what Mercedes was saying was so important about the women at Bayside, about what not only people having inside them and not be, having to be taught, but that if you... How many people here have visited prison? And have visited, you know, how many people have been part of a group in prison? You know that you learn more from people than you... bring in. You know, I've had that experience so many times where people tell me, oh, I'm going to teach a poetry class in a prison. And I say, oh, great. So I really want to help people. And I say, okay, little missionary, go on. And it's always true. And it's not just because people respond under oppression to, you know, and become and find their humanity even more than normal. It's also because everything is very, you see things that you missed. Mm-hmm. And it's why the prison movement in the 70s created a lot of the revolutionary spirit in the movement outside. So, anyway.
So I wanted to also open this up to questions from you all, so that, that way it's not just, you know, us framing the conversation, but if there are questions you have or things that this brings up for you. Yeah?
I've never been in the U.S. prison system. In England, I worked as a teacher, a maths teacher, in adult male.
Can people hear her?
Sorry. Would you like the microphone?
Yeah.
I don't mind. So I've never been in the U.S. prison, but in England, I worked as a maths teacher in adult male prisons. And, I mean, you definitely seem a bit sceptical of education. I can see, I understand where you're coming from. But I wanted to know, like, what interaction you had with education departments, whether there is any provision. Did it help in any way? Did it hinder in any way? Yeah, just general thoughts.
Well, in New York State, I can speak to the differences of men versus women. There are more opportunities for higher education for men than there are for women. During the time that I was in Bedford, there were volunteers, colleges coming in and offering an associate's degree level, I believe. That was the highest level for women. But in the men's facility, they had the opportunity to get a master's degree. And most of them received their master's degree in theology. So they studied sociology and psychology. During the time that I was in prison, I taught ABE. Basically, we wanted women to actually have their GED before they were released, because at least that gives folks some footing, you know. But the opportunities, you know, and the self-initiative to take on those opportunities, they have to be there. Like I said, women are sometimes... The experiences that they've had prior to their incarceration, if they've been abused prior to their incarceration, if they've been if they've had any type of abuse, physical, spiritual, emotional, it's exacerbated in the prison system, because there are not the supports that a person needs. There's not an appropriate diagnosis of the issue. Many women are depressed. and it's exacerbated during their incarceration. A lot of women do not receive the supports, the familial supports that men receive, because women are looked at differently. Women are seen as morally inept if they go to prison. So, because you're supposed to be the mother, you're supposed to be the caretaker, the guardian, the one that makes sure that the family doesn't fall apart. So if a woman goes to prison, she takes all of that into prison with her. Again, from our society and the way that our society sees women, the way that we internalize this and see ourselves, we carry a lot of blame, shame, and guilt with our during our incarceration. So all of this is a part of, you know, what happens to women specifically when they go inside. I lost my train of thought.
It's a really important question, also partly because prisoners used to be able to get college education in prison, and then someone in the legislature discovered that prisoners were getting educations, and so through Pell Grants, right, which are available for people in society too, which is a grant to go to college, and so they cut off Pell Grants for the prisons. And I was in prison when that happened, and there were women, and you know, there were women who hadn't had time when no one had given them money to go to college. If they hadn't been sexual abused, they had been abused through their life experiences, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And so there was a class at this one, again, the control unit prison I was in, which was only 100 women altogether, so you really knew what was going on. And there was this group of women who were taking a college class, and a professor would come in and teach every twice a week. They worked so hard. They were constantly talking with each other, studying, asking other people questions about stuff, and it was like sparkling. It was like you could see life happening. People were reading all the stuff they had never read. And then the Pell Grants were cut off. And the atmosphere in that prison just changed. And the level of just sort of good stuff that was going on got worse. You know, it fell in the competitiveness and the just depression and all of that. And so I do think education is extremely important. And in the federal system now, at least as far as I know, and this was true when I left, if you wanted to take a class, it had to be a mail order, you know, by, what do you call it, correspondence course. And when people did that, we would get together and you know, help people with the class. But it's still, it's a very different thing. So I think education is extremely important. My only point was that you learn as much from the prisoners, depending, you know, it depends on the structure of the thing. And the other thing that I was involved with was a course called Poetry for the People. June Jordan, a wonderful poet who died, I don't know how long ago, 5, 6, 8 years ago, started this program called Poetry for the People, which was based on what had happened in Nicaragua during and after the revolution, where there were poetry workshops for some of the fighters and the people that were being organized. And so in these students from June Jordan's class would come into the prison, women, I'm still friends with them, because we formed such great bonds. And there would be about 20 of us who went to this classroom, and it wasn't just write, you know, free-form poems. It was a really interesting program where we were taught about different forms of poetics, and then you had to write a poem based on that. And the thing that was so amazing about it, you know, it was, for all of us, it was a way of expressing things that we couldn't say in a form. But for one of the women who came one week wrote a poem about her arrest, and it was stuff she had never told anyone, but she was able to bring it out through poetry, you know, by making it a third person. She read the poem to everyone. Everyone's like gasping. It was this horrendous situation where her kid was there, and kid was crying, 4-year-old kid just sitting on the floor crying, and the police are dragging her away, and then what they did to her when she was in the jail and all of that. And at the end she said, it was about me. And it was the first time she had told anyone. And so, and after that, she, you know, it was like she had gone through an experience of Yeah, it was cathartic. So I think that the one good thing that can happen in prison is education. And as soon as they close that down, the more they close that down. And a lot of the teaching that goes on is bullshit. They had, you know, they had some teachers at this one prison that I was in, but I wouldn't have listened to them tell me how to use a telephone book. But mostly I think it's a great thing to do. Do you remember?
Yeah, I remember my thoughts now. So self-expression is really important. And so we have to distinguish between what happens in the women's prison versus a men's prison. And unfortunately here in New York State, men's prisons get a little bit more. You know, there are schools that volunteer to come in. There's Bard College. There are programs that are run by people currently who were incarcerated to bring college courses into the prisons. And there are a lot of volunteers, but still, women tend to get the short end of the stick. There's an organization here in New York called the College and Community Fellowship. And there's also another organization called the College Initiative. And these two programs, one is run by a formerly incarcerated woman. And these particular programs offer opportunities for support while formerly incarcerated people are seeking a higher education. And they have, amongst their participants that have gone through this process, a 2% recidivism rate. So anyone that has experienced prison, that has received an education, whether it began inside or continued after, is so important to a person being able to see themselves as actively participating in their lives and in what their goals are. You know, you can't survive doing the same things and thinking the same way and expect to be successful. Once you have an education, once that door opens up, then like Laura said, there's lights and sparks flashing everywhere, you know, and an opportunity for full self-expression and then to really see the system as it is and what it's trying to do to you.
We also did it with AIDS education because AIDS was, when I was in prison, I got locked up in 85 and it was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. Not the beginning, but, you know, it was pretty early. And people didn't, you know, there was before it was HIV even, because we knew HIV caused AIDS, but there were no medications or anything. So it was like life and death information. And that was also incredibly empowering. And there are AIDS programs that have been set up. There's a wonderful book about Bedford called Breaking the Walls of Silence, which Vicki talks about in her introduction, that's about the process of mounting an attack on AIDS through education and peer support, and how revolutionary that was and how much that enabled people to resist, form of resistance.
Yeah. That was actually a form of resistance that went national and started in the women's prison. And all of the men's prisons ended up taking that program over.
The person in the back?
I'm curious as to how difficult or what was the process behind organizing within prison. Like, because I know being out of prison, I have no experience being incarcerated and having to organize within an oppressive state, like, or an oppressive institution like that. I'm curious to see, or to hear your experience of how organized this is for you.
Okay, so first read Vicki's book, because that's all what it's about. But you won't, you know, sometimes you'll go, wait a second, what does this have to do with organizing? But when you think about what it takes to build a group, it does. But, I mean, one of the main things about organizing in prison is that what makes it hard is that, especially in women's prison, and Vicki talks about this a lot in her book, is that the threat of having your connection to your family on the outside and to your kids cut off is huge. So it makes it very difficult to get people to, you know, organize like a sit down or something like that. However, to organize, to create alternatives inside the body of the prison is a little bit easier if you do it clandestinely. And so there are examples of that in Vicki's book. But I think for us around AIDS, it was really hard at first because no one wanted to be associated with anything. We had a health fair in 1990 at Lexington Federal Prison where I was, which was also the hospital for the federal system for women. So there were 2,400 women there, and there were probably 150 who had AIDS, and or more than 150. And people were dying, and people were scared. And we had a health fair that wasn't even called an AIDS health fair, but there was a banner that involved with it that said AIDS. And I had a friend who was there, who I later was friends with in another prison, and she said, and she was in our AIDS group later, but she said, I was scared to go to that because I didn't want someone to think I had AIDS. So there's a lot of stuff about what your information is, you know, if you're going to a certain group. When we had AIDS peer support groups, we had to put, we met in a chapel, but we had to put sheets on all the windows because people didn't want to be seen at the, you know, at the meeting. So there were all those bars, because in prison, being known as having AIDS in those days meant that you were a target of violence. You were people wouldn't sit at your table in the mess hall. The cops wouldn't want to come near you. They didn't want to give you food. You know, a lot of stuff like that. So those were things. But those were particular right then. I think later, mostly it was the fear of having your time extended. You know, you'd be threatened. People would be threatened if you joined that group. You know, you'll never go home. You know, you won't get parole, this and that. But the main thing I want to talk about is what's the biggest challenge, which is that for the prison administration, empowerment of prisoners is a security threat.
Yeah.
So Elaine Lord, whom Tina and Mercedes were talking about before, who was the warden at Bedford. Well, she went back and forth, and for a while she let this AIDS group operate, and then she freaked out at a certain point and closed it down, and then she opened it up again. But she wrote the introduction to that book, Breaking the Walls of Silence, and she says something amazing for a warden. She says, self-empowerment of prisoners is threatening to administrators, but it doesn't have to be. And that doesn't have to be is, like I said, what? She's really doing this. But that's a real leap. So, for example, we had a really great AIDS education group in California in a federal prison near San Francisco. And they shut it down. The administration just shut it down. We had to have a guard at every meeting. We had to have a medical staff person. Well, no one's going to talk with a guard there. What, people are going to ask us, how can me and my girlfriend have safe sex? It's illegal to have sex in prison. So we had nothing, you know, at that point. We got shut down and we had to meet secretly, just, you know, sitting around a table in the dining room, and only four people could meet. So that was a big thing. The other thing is that organizing in prison is just like organizing in the street in one way, which is that you can never decide this is the issue people are going to get behind. It comes from what people are moved by. You know, in Lexington prison, I tried everything. It was the most repressive, horrible, racist place. And I would, every time they would do something awful to us, I would say to my friends, let's march on the lieutenant's office. And I would say, okay, right after camp. And I would get out there and there would be two other people with me, you know. they would do these horrendous things to us. And then, finally, and there were a lot of things were happening outside, like there was the Rodney King, the verdict, the Simi Valley acquittal of the cops who beat up and kicked Rodney King on camera. And, you know, no one did anything. A few of us made little stickers and put them up, you know, saying with little slogans, and then, of course, they got taken right down. But about 3 months later, a guard attacked a black woman during an argument that she was having with someone else, a verbal argument, threw her to the ground in front of all her friends, and she wasn't in the argument, she was just standing there. But he didn't know, she was black, the people who were arguing were black, he just jumped her, really hurt her, and locked her up. And she happened to be Haitian, and the Haitian community was very cohesive, it was small but cohesive, partly a language issue, partly just culture. And so they some of the leaders of the Haitian community came to some of us in the other communities and said, we're going to do something. Not asking us, just telling us, we're not going to go into camp tomorrow. And 90 of us joined them. And I was amazed. And I turned to my friend, my dear friend. She and I had been trying to organize all the time. She was totally respected. She was the head of the JCs. She was the head of the Muslim community. And we looked at each other and we said, how did this happen? But you just don't know. So you just like keep trying. You talk to people. You build whatever little groups you can. And then at some point an issue grabs people. It's like Stop and Frisk. Who knew Stop and Frisk would do it? People have been organizing against it. The Malcolm X grassroots movement has been organizing against Stop and Frisk and has been organizing cop art since I got out of prison and before then. Who knew that all of a sudden on Father's Day there would be this huge demonstration with things like the United Federation of Teachers, which has never been known for anti-racism. You know, at some point an issue just takes off and you just have to be ready for it. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
Well, one other thing that I found out when I was looking at instances of resistance and organizing in women's prisons. So originally I started this research because I didn't find anything. Like, I was in college and I decided to do a paper on prison organizing post Attica. Like, what happens after COINTELPRO is decimated, all these movements? What happens when people are either dead, disbanded, or in prison? What happens to the prison justice movement and the prisoners' rights movement? And at the end of the semester, I look back and everything was about men, you know, and I'm like, wait, that's not right, you know. So I start asking people who've been involved in prison justice organizing for decades, like, where are the women? And they're like, they don't organize, they don't resist. They're not doing any of this stuff that you're talking about. Nope.
We're making
just, it. Yep, they just made all that up. And I was like, that can't be right. Like, how can there be, I forget what the number was, it wasn't 100,000 women yet, you know, in prison, but like, how can there be this many, like, tens of thousands of women in prison and like not a single one of them is doing anything about, you know, these awful prison injustices? So I started looking at what the conditions were that faced women, and obviously some of them are really different, like, you know, like care for children and the responsibility of, you know, caretaking. Some of them like abuse and battering. And then I also started seeing that when you've got different issues, you've also got different ways of organizing. And some of it is not the kind of thing that you can turn into like a nice statistic. Like, how can we quantify Tina not losing her son and getting into the nursery program versus how many women didn't? Like, it's not an easy thing to quantify. So those lines of communication that Tina was able to tap into and use to keep her son aren't necessarily things that get put into, like, you know, the all-encompassing history of prison organizing in the 1990s. One of the things I also found out was that, like, battered women were doing organizing specifically around domestic violence at a time, like, in the mid to late 80s and early 90s, where people weren't necessarily talking about domestic violence or abuse or battering as an issue. It was, like, something that happened to you and you kept really quiet about it. If you went to prison for killing your abuser, it wasn't something that the courts would consider. It wasn't something that even you would consider, because you'd be like, oh, God, I killed my husband, you know? I must be awful. And it wasn't like, you didn't deserve all those times that you were hurt and that you were harmed and that, you know, your partner hurt you or beat you or whatever, whatever. And in some of the women's prisons, women started organizing just a support group. So it wasn't even organizing. They formed a support group. They said, we're all having long sentences. Let's try to get through this together, you know? This is not considered, like, radically political organizing by most people. When they look at it, it looks like a support group. And then they all got together, and they realized that so many of them had long-to-life sentences for killing their abusers. And then they started realizing that, you know, like, this was an issue. This was an actual issue. It wasn't just that, like, your story happened, and your story happened, and your story happened, and they're all in a vacuum, and they're all awful people because you finally fought back. And then what they decided to do is they decided to apply for clemency. So this was in the state of Ohio. And they asked the governor to consider clemency, not only for themselves, but for other women as well who might be incarcerated for self-defense, you know, for defending themselves against their abusers. And then they went out onto the units, into the, like, mess halls, onto the yard, any place where you might find another woman. And they started talking, and they started talking with them about what they were in for, what that relationship had been like, help them figure out that that was abuse. That isn't, that's not love when somebody's always hurting you. You know, that's not love when somebody's controlling you. That's not love when all this violence is happening. And while it might be sad, it might be unfortunate, it might be tragic that you had to take this person's life, it's not your fault, and you don't deserve to be in prison forever and ever and ever and ever. And in the end, 25 additional women signed on to apply for clemency. So this is 25 additional women that might have sat in prison forever and ever and ever thinking, God, I'm such an awful person. I can't believe I killed, you know, this person that I love and who loved me, and not understanding what abuse looks like, what battering looks like. And in the end, I don't remember the exact number. You can look at it in the book later. The governor pardoned a whole bunch of these women, and it was the first mass clemency around battered women sentenced to prison for killing their abusers. And, you know, and that's not necessarily what these women originally set out to do. They set out to support each other through their long sentences, and that turns into more. But again, it's not the kind of thing that you can look at and be like, that is a political project. Those, you know, those 10 women sitting in a room supporting each other through their long sentences is going to turn into something that you can, like, quantify into a success statistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect example.
Yep.
Hi. So, building off of your comments that you never know what's going to sort of grab public consciousness in criminal justice issues that have been around for a long time, what do you think are the particular issues right now that might really cut through, either in terms of achieving some kind of political or legislative change, or sort of bursting into the public consciousness? Like, you're working against women being shackled during labor and delivery. Like, I'm assuming you're doing because you think something could happen now, and it's been going on forever, but there must be something powerful about it now. What are other issues specific to women that are sort of on the cusp in that way?
Good question.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, I mean, particular to women, I mean, I think that there are, again, the domestic violence issue. We have a piece of legislation that we're working on around the Justice Act, and it's for women who've committed violent crimes against their abuser. That's one here in New York. There are a couple of colleagues of mine working on sex worker legislation. I'm trying to think of who else is doing some phenomenal work for women. Here in New York, we're also looking at the busing, the free busing for families. And that's specific for women, because women and men are in prisons outside of the New York State area, you know, this area. We have one women's prison that is close to the Canadian border. And most of the women are placed there who have their sentence structures below a violent crime. So there's about 1,500 women, and so most of them have children. And it's hard for families to get up there. And so when they took away the free buses, it became even harder because it's an eight-hour drive. And so if you're from the city, do you have a car? No, more than likely you don't. And there's no subway that runs up to Albion. And so the children are without having visits. And for children who are in foster care, the state has to take the children to visit their parents, no matter where they are, at least once a month in the state, twice a month in the city. But if the child is being taken care of, and most children are taken care of by family members, if a child is being taken care of by a family member, they already have other children that they're taking care of. And how do they afford to make sure that this child is visiting with their parent, but through the free buses? So the sex worker legislation, the free buses, the justice criminal, the Safe Justice Act, which is for domestic violence, those are the three that I can think of right now.
And shackling. I mean, shackling thing. But I don't know about specifically about women, but I do think that one way to look at this is that an issue that has sort of sparked some is solitary confinement. And I think the reason is because who started? I mean, that people have been working on that issue and exposing it for years. But what happened, it was a year ago now, or more than a year, is that in Pelican Bay, do people know what Pelican Bay is? Horrendous, horrendous, special, these modern prisons that are set up so that no human, you know, no human contact ever has to go on, and people are in isolation units. It was built, and it's in Northern California, Pelican Bay, California, right? And it was built to control the gang problem in the prisons, you know, which is a myth, another myth, like that there's a drug problem in the United States. It's such a huge thing. Not that there aren't gangs, not that there aren't, isn't gang warfare, but not that it's, you know, it's the biggest thing. And a guy in New York was just accused of, charged with terrorism for a gang incident. So, but anyways, I won't talk about that. But the Pelican Bay is where people are sent, put into total isolation for 23 hours a day for years. And the only way, the way you get in there is that some other prisoner says that you're a gang member, or there's some kind of evidence that you're a gang member. And the only way you can get out is by giving the names of other gang members to prove it. It's like the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 50s. How do you prove you weren't a communist? You know, how can you prove you're not something without snitching on other people? So the prisoners there, and in Corcoran, which is another California prison that has pretty awful conditions and a lot of use of solitary confinement, prisoners went on hunger strike who were in solitary confinement. And that is a huge thing to do in prison, not only because you get hungry and food is the one slight comfort you have, especially if you're in solitary, but also because if you refuse to eat, then you can be force-fed, and that's a pretty disgusting, painful process. All right, so they went on hunger strike, it didn't make big news, but for a lot of people who were already prison justice activists, it said something. It said, wait a second, and they said they were going to hunger strike to the death. And there was another hunger strike in Ohio, right? I think it was Ohio. So the fact that prisoners were saying, this is an issue, folks, take it seriously, filtered down. And I mean, just last Thursday, State Senator Bill Perkins, who's pretty involved in criminal justice issues, had a town hall meeting about solitary confinement in New York State. So it's not the same thing as, you know, Occupy jumping off, or the stop and frisk thing jumping off in a way that meant that people were, you know, resisting and doing demonstrations and all that. But it is a big issue that I think has touched people's consciousness. I think the whole crisis of mass incarceration is one of those. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if anyone here was at the Riverside Church event on September 14th, I think it was, with Angela Davis and Michelle Alexander and Mark Lamont Hill and Sophia Elijah and Pam Africa and Jazz Hayden. And I was sick, so I watched it live streaming. Talk about someone who never touched a computer before. Now I'm there, I tweet and everything. And so I'm lying in bed, like with a fever, watching it, and it was amazing. You could feel the energy, and I was texting with Sophia during it. She was up in the front. She said, the energy is amazing. There were 2,000 people, and you know, then we did a demonstration to close Attica a few days later, and the state wants to meet with people about it. Who knew? You know, this head of security for the state of New York wants to meet with people. I mean, it's just taken a bit of a turn. So I'm hoping that actually is the issue, and then all these other things fit into it. And if other people, I mean, you're out there, you're doing the organizing too. People probably have ideas.
I have a question. How does transgender issues fit into all of this? From thinking about Cece, it's just refreshed myself Cece, that these issues that people have been organizing in prisons for decades now.
It's true. Cece McDonald, Cece McDonald, people know who she is? Okay. No, Cece McDonald is a transgender woman who, African-American transgender woman. I'm seeing her face in front of me. I don't say that. Minnesota. Who, just like the New Jersey Four here some years ago, black lesbians who had a similar situation, she was hassled outside a bar. She spoke back. She stood up for herself. A fight ensued. Her face was slashed with a knife immediately by this homophobic person, transphobic person, and she ended up stabbing the person, and she was charged with murder, and she was going to go for a terrible long sentence. And there was, you know, I think it was partly because transgender people who, like Leslie Feinberg, who wrote first wrote Stone Butch Blues years ago, then she wrote Transgender Warrior, and has been bringing that issue to the left, not just as a separate issue, but to the left. And when I talked before about how prisons enforce gender roles, and I wish Mercedes were still here, because she gave me the best image of why she thinks that prisons are so transphobic, and why the male guards in prison are terrified of the whole concept of especially of men who don't want to be men, and of women who can be men, you know, and all of that. But anyway, so I think that Cece's case then took off because it was such a clear injustice, and because it was almost exactly what had happened to the New Jersey Four here. I won't go into that. If you don't know about these cases, look them up. They're all, you know, Google, you'll find them. And because there has been a movement among transgender people, Sylvia Rivera Law Project, which is about to celebrate their 10th anniversary on November 8th, everyone is invited, I believe. So that issue, because it shows not only the inhumanity, but the real utter repression in every single aspect of society that's carried out by the police, the courts, and the prisons. And also I think, you know, transgender people have been leading a lot of the prison justice work, certainly in California, also here, leading a lot of the AIDS work, leading a lot of, you know, talking about people who said, you know what, we're tired of being quiet, we're tired of saying, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, oh, yes, oh, you don't like the way I look, okay, you know, and it's, you know, so there's leadership, same as Pelican Bay, there's leadership from people who experience the brunt, you know, and if you think prisons are bad, try being a transgender woman in the midst of transitioning who is sent to a male prison. And I spoke on a panel once with the Rivera sisters who had both were transgender women who, and one of them had been sent to Clinton. And I visited Clinton for a long time because my friend David Gilbert was there. And it's by the Canadian border, and it is utterly, like, there is, you don't have a sense that anyone would hear you scream whatever happens to you. And this woman was put into isolation there, which meant that she didn't have the support of the decent men prisoners who would have supported her. But she was completely at the mercy of the guards. And so, yeah, I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. Thank you.
I forget what your original question is, because I was listening, but
it's just wanted to know more about it, how it fit into the, and how conscious it was, because it's something that I haven't really...
It's an issue, I think, that's gaining more recognition. I mean, there have always been people who have been incarcerated for, like, not fitting the gender norms, like when women's prisons first were opened, you know, and especially this idea of women's reformatories in the late 1880s, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, like, women could be sent to prison for not fitting these reformatories to reform them out of not fitting gender norms. I don't know if there's, like, a correlating number of men who are also sent to, you know, or if they were just allowed to do whatever they pleased because we're still a very patriarchal, male-dominated society. But, so women would be sent to reformatories because they didn't appear feminine enough. They weren't acting feminine enough. And then in the women's prisons, there weren't reformatories then and now. People who identify as women even report that, like, you know, like when they don't fit these ideas of femininity, they're targeted. Trans women or trans folks are often placed in prisons based on the gender that they're assigned at birth, not on the gender that they identify as, no matter what. There have been cases in which trans folks have taken prison systems to court and won certain rights, either the right to be placed in the prison with of the gender that they identify with, or the right to be able to continue hormone therapy, or, you know, be able to wear women support things like bras or panties, you know, and be able to, like, shave and things that, you know, like, that they need. I'm sorry, I'm getting tired, so I'm like, oh, I'm babbling. You know, but I'm also seeing that, like, we're, like, you know, like, more and more we're starting to see intersections between, you know, like, what happens to trans folks on the outside. You know, why is it that a disproportionate number of trans people end up, like, criminalized? You know, like, what are the systems that are pushing them out, you know, like, enforcing that? You know, like what are the systems of oppression that act upon them? And then we're also seeing that, like, you know, people in prison reform, prisoners' rights, prison abolition movements are also taking note of this now and being like, oh, wait a minute, you know, it's not just, you know, like, it's not all about men. You know, when we talk about mass incarceration, that's the first thing that comes up. But it's also not about men and women. It's like, you know, like, there's all sorts of people that get affected by criminalization, you know, and that's something to look at is, like, where are the, what are the intersections between mass incarceration, imprisonment, criminalization, and whatever issues, you know, and identities that you identify with or that you're working on. So, like, if you're working around, you know, trans issues, it's not like, oh, that's prison, that doesn't affect me, you know, and at the same time, people working on prison issues also shouldn't be like, yeah, I'm a cisgendered woman, I don't need to, you know, work with you on that either.
Just following up on that, I hear this sort of, you know, in some of the things you're talking about is that there's a somewhat growing consciousness about this awareness about the complexity of the issues within the prison system, but also relating to it, this work has to happen out here, outside the system. And that what you were saying is like it's just intensified and stripped bare in the prison. But what do you do when you come out here when there's all these the distractions and the perks and the grease with the squeakiness and the balms to just, you know, hide it all? And then you come out here and we're supposed to be free here, right?
Right.
And so we're supposed to be thankful, you know. And so I'm curious about that sort of polemic, you know, between what us being free here too and allowing people to come in and join the struggle here.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the Safia book, in the introduction, I was putting together Safia Bukhari's writings that she had left. She wasn't a writer, she was an activist. But her daughter had found things that she had written. So I started with that, and then I started gathering other things. And as I was finishing it, my girlfriend said to me, you know, I think at your party when you came out of prison, Safia spoke. So I found the tape that someone had made me of that party, and I played what she wrote. And it was amazing. She said something that so spoke to me. It was, you know, when you come out, you're not free because part of you remains in prison. But also, she had also said to me, not on the tape, but another time, but your sense of freedom is completely changed. Because, you know, I know this is, people used to say this Buddhist, I read a Buddhist book when I was in prison, and I was like, oh yeah, right. It said you can be free in a prison cell. But it's true, because it has so much to do with how much of a human being you feel you are tapping, how much of your humanity you feel like you're tapping into. So I actually find some things harder about being out than being in. And a lot of people say that. There are certain ways of expression that are more difficult. There are certain ways of talking, you know. And for me, the main thing is that it's in the prison outside is invisible. And I feel like I'm a nutcase talking about it all the time. Well, it's capitalism. Well, but, you know, I went one day, I was waiting for my girlfriend. She was at the, I wish she were here, because I keep saying my girlfriend. Anyway, Susie Day. She had to go to the doctor, and we had to be on the Upper West Side. So I thought, oh, I'll go to some galleries. I'll go to the Museum of Folk Art. I've never been there. I'll do all these things. But it was early on a Friday. It was like 11 o'clock, and all those places aren't open. And it was freezing out, so I end up going to the Time Warner Center. Has anyone been there? I'd only been there to go to a jazz concert once. But it's, and I said, so when she got out of the doctor, she said, well, what museum did you go to? And I said, the Museum of Capitalism. And she looked at me, she said, oh, Time Warner Center. So when I say that to most people, they don't quite get it. It's the mind control, the sense of, oh my God, I'm not tall, I'm not thin, I'm not whatever that model is, I don't have money, I don't have all of those things, but also the fact that everything that we have now is being sold to us, including our health care, you know, Affordable Care Act, you know, better than nothing, I guess, but I hate it because it's the insurance companies getting total control over the health care system now. It's not just, you know, so, but it's invisible, so it's harder to figure out how to fight. And in prison, it was clear. That's why I ended up in the halls so much. I mean, they wouldn't give you sanitary napkins. I said, oh, I'm sorry, we're out. We would say, that toilet paper, this, both of these things happen. And we would start, you know, not going into camp, doing all these things, and you'd end up in the hall. But that was clear, as opposed to the forms of control that go on out here. So to me, that makes it harder. And since I feel most free when I'm, I don't want to say fighting because that sounds so, you know, but when I'm struggling for what I believe in, that actually does mean that, you know, it's kind of a kind of answer, but
it's a good answer.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've been smoking
something. I
think your question is a good question. I think that when we have discussions with people who've not experienced prison, we can talk about the issue and the issue be the reason. But the experience, you're kind of lacking unless you have a conversation with someone. And then still, that's that individual's lived experience. You haven't had it. So we can talk about how oppressive and how dehumanizing it is. And you wouldn't even think of going through something that that person has experienced. You might halt someone at oppressing you or dehumanizing you immediately and feel that that response that you make will not have any repercussions. But when you're listening to someone inside who say, okay, so, you know, you can't deny me toilet paper, right? And where is my toilet paper? And the fact that the person has to ask for toilet paper, you know, is bad enough, you know. When a person is explaining this to you, I don't know what it is that you feel. And you're like, And you cannot really relate to that experience because you're just saying to yourself, well, it's toilet paper. Why would I deny somebody toilet paper? You know? But that's the issue. And so it's real. It's, I always say that, you know, in some cases, in some ways, that prison is unrelated to real life. You know? And it is easier because you do know what exactly is coming at you. Out here, you don't know what's coming at you, and explaining the differences and the challenges to someone who might take up an issue because they find that equally, it's, you know, and agree that it's dehumanizing, is like to understand the breadth of the experience that a person has is something that you will not have. You know, one of the things that we did as a group over the summer was to identify 10 ways in which to be an ally, right? And this original document was written by a white guy who wrote it for, I guess, his comrades, and we broke it down so that it would be more related to people of color. And we identified that folks who wanted to ally with us to sit at the table and identify with particular issues that we know are across the board that human beings feel. You know, emotions. Like, have you ever felt guilty? Have you ever felt ashamed of something? Did you do something wrong? You know, did someone close to you say that whatever you did was wrong? Or did someone ever put you down? To kind of like get at that basic stuff, you know, and if you could begin to talk about that basic stuff, if you can begin to give of yourself, then more than likely you could become a good ally. You wouldn't be patronizing. You wouldn't be, you know, thinking that, well, if I've got a lot of money, then money is the thing that needs to solve the problem. No, it's not always money. We work for no money, you know, and the issues that we work on, we definitely find them important. So how do you work on things without always having a fixed thinking it's money, you know? Allies can come and do the work and offer their expertise. And what I find for me that's difficult is when allies feel like, well, I've not had this experience, so this is your conversation, I don't want to interrupt. I think that if you can identify emotionally what you've gone through, that you're a part of this conversation. Yes, you've not had the experience, but you can relate to it in some way or talk about it in some way. And being really honest, you know, is how you work that out. I mean, if you don't want to ever be oppressed, or if you felt dehumanized and you don't like it, then you can pretty much understand what a person has experienced in prison, you know. But I think that question is really good. Like, how do you get people activated around this, you know, especially prison, because you don't want to, you know, all people are tough on crime. You go out this door today, right? You look at a young man that's coming down the street with his pants sagging down, right? If you're a white woman, you're probably going to grab your purse and switch it over to the left side, right? Because you don't know, right? So, I mean, we have to be conscious of how it is that we act around people just by things that we've heard. The media plays a huge role in us making decisions about people, and we make those decisions blindly. And, you know, I think that, you know, those things are the things that we need to sit down and talk about. You know, we don't talk about race. We don't talk about the impact from both sides. We don't talk about how we've all played a role in it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And how we recapitulate the relationships of prison on
yep.
the outside.
Yeah.
You know, and how we see that. I think that's, you know, when you talk about the school to prison pipeline, it's a really clear example. But, you know, when I was a kid, there were no metal detectors. No schools had that kind of cops. And every time I talk to parents of school-age kids, that's the thing that they talk about. So, and all of those things are a continuation, you know, between prison and the outside, and making those connections, and then understanding that until we dismantle the structure now of punishment, that is so, you know, people are furious about the NDAA and about all of the taking away of all of our rights and all of that, but as long as we allow the prison system to continue as it is, that's our complicity with giving away our own rights. And so, you know.
Ooh. No. Okay, so it has just been pointed out to me, and I've noticed people have been kind of like shifting around, that it is 9:30. You guys have been awesome because you've sat through 2 hours of, like, you know, really heavy talk about prison organizing, repression. So I wanted to, like, wrap up the, like, sort of, like, sit down in your seat portion of it. Like, we'll be around for a little bit afterwards if you want to, like, come up and continue individual conversations, but not have everybody be seated. There are copies of my book and Laura's book, or Laura's edited book of Safiya Bukhari's writings there. If you want to look through them, purchase both. And thank you all for coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.